This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. I'm Sally Sara. This Tuesday, a grim day as more Australians are plunged into COVID lockdown. And hacked off, the US and other nations point the finger at China for a large-scale computer sabotage campaign.
It's important that countries, including Australia, call out bad online behaviour. There needs to be much greater discourse globally about what sanctions there could or couldn't be applied either against individuals and also states themselves.
As the Delta variant continues its spread, another state is going into lockdown. South Australians will shut up shop at 6pm tonight, joining Victoria and New South Wales under stay-at-home orders. Victoria's lockdown will be extended by another week, and New South Wales is still a long way from bringing its outbreak under control. More on those numbers shortly. But first today, we do start in Victoria, where the Premier Daniel Andrews has announced the statewide lockdown will continue for an extra 7 days. And the border will be closed to anyone who's been in a New South Wales red zone unless they're essential workers or successfully apply for a permit on compassionate grounds. The state of Victoria recorded 13 new cases today. One of those is yet to be linked to an existing outbreak. Our reporter in Melbourne, Samantha Donovan, joins me now. Sam, it's a feeling of deja vu, I think, the situation the country is in. In Victoria, how has the Premier justified the extension of the lockdown?
Well, certainly a very familiar situation for Victorians, Sally, and Melburnians in particular. But the Premier, in announcing the extension of the lockdown today, has said that more time is needed to stamp out these outbreaks of the Delta variant. But he's confident we can get out of lockdown in 7 days' time. So, as you mentioned, 13 new cases were announced today. We knew about four of them late yesterday. Mr. Andrews says it's very promising that 9 of those 13 people were in isolation for all of their infectious period. But the Chief Health Officer, Brett Sutton, believes another 7 days is needed to stamp out the Delta variant. So until midnight on Tuesday, 27th of July, we're looking at now. When the lockdown was announced last week, Sally, the Premier indicated he'd release parts of regional Victoria early if it was safe to do so. But there's no sign of that now. He pointed out that a third of the primary close contacts of the 85 active cases in the state are in regional Victoria. Here's Daniel Andrews announcing the extension of the lockdown this morning.
We need to avoid what's going on in Sydney at the moment, and we are determined to do that. So far, the strategy is unfolding exactly the way we'd like it to unfold. We've had a couple of transmission events where large numbers of people have finished up positive as a result of being in proximity close to others for a very short period of time. Some of those stranger-to-stranger issues, that the speed with which this has moved through the Victorian community confirms that we did the right thing to lock down, and it also sadly confirms that we need more time.
It's Daniel Andrews there. And Sam, what's happening with travel arrangements to Victoria, especially the declaration of red zones?
Yes, so from 11:59 tonight, no one will be allowed to travel from the New South Wales red zones into Victoria unless they're authorised workers or if they successfully make an application on compassionate grounds. That restriction will be in place for the next 2 weeks. So up until now, people from the red zones, Sydney and the surrounding areas, have been able to come to Victoria with a permit, but they needed to quarantine at home for 14 days. We know at least one of those people broke the conditions of their permit, went out shopping at a supermarket and passed the virus on, and that started a chain of transmission. So the Premier, Daniel Andrews, announced this morning he's putting an end to that red zone permit process.
For 4 weeks, we've been saying to people from Victoria who are in Sydney and now in broader New South Wales, not the bubble, but I mean beyond that border bubble, we've been saying, come home. Come home because the rules may change. Well, the rules are changing today. There will be no further, as of right, red zone travel for the next 2 weeks. Things are too unstable, too uncertain, and frankly, out of control from a virus point of view in Sydney. And we need to protect Victoria and Victorians, and indeed beyond that, the rest of the nation.
That's the Victorian Premier, Daniel Andrews, there. Before that, our reporter in Melbourne, Samantha Donovan. Well, let's hop across the border now to South Australia. And SA will go into lockdown at 6 p.m. tonight after the Delta variant spread into the community. Our reporter in Adelaide, Rhett Burney, joins us now with the details. Rhett, how many cases are there and what are the restrictions that the Premier, Stephen Marshall, has announced?
Hi, Sally. There are 5 cases now. 3 are close contacts of that first case diagnosed yesterday, which is an 81-year-old man in the northern suburbs. Exactly where he got the virus isn't yet clear. We know that he was in hotel quarantine in Sydney after coming home from Argentina last month, and he had a fall while in the hotel and served out the remainder of his quarantine at a Sydney hotel and then came back to Adelaide on July 8. Now, the Premier, Stephen Marshall, has just spoken. He says a 5th person's been diagnosed this morning. That's after 3 other close contacts of that man were traced. Now, one of those, the latest case dined at the Greek on Halifax, that's in the CBD, on Saturday night, where one of the close contacts was also in attendance. Gyms and non-essential retail were closed from midnight, but now from 6 o'clock tonight, the entire state enters a hard lockdown. You can only leave home for the 5 reasons, so groceries, medical attention, providing care, getting a vaccine, essential work or exercise. And with exercise, you can only do that with others from your home. There are no social bubbles for singles or intimate partner bubbles. The Premier says at this stage these restrictions will be in place for 7 days and his government is discussing support for businesses. Here's Stephen Marshall speaking a short time ago.
Well, obviously I've spoken with the Prime Minister today and we should be very comfortable in expecting the same level of support that has been offered to both New South Wales and Victoria. And in addition to that, the Treasurer, Rob Lucas, is now looking at what immediate support we can provide to people here in our state. We know that these restrictions will have a very heavy toll on individuals, on businesses here in South Australia. We don't take these decisions lightly, but we also need to get the balance right. If we let this run for too much longer, we could be in an extended lockdown situation in South Australia. And that's something that we have always wanted to avoid.
That's the South Australian Premier, Stephen Marshall, and before him, our reporter in Adelaide, Rhett Burney. Well, there's been a drop in new COVID case numbers in New South Wales, but the number of people being diagnosed while they've been in the community remains stubbornly high. And authorities are stressing the virus remains dangerous, with 11 people in the state now on ventilators in intensive care. Our reporter Isabel Rowe joins me. Isabel, good afternoon. The number of people being diagnosed in the community has increased. What are the authorities saying about that?
Yeah, Sally, there's 78 cases today and 21 of those have been in the community for the whole time they were infectious, 8 for part of that time. And that's not good because it's the number that New South Wales Health says needs to be as close to zero as possible before New South Wales or Greater Sydney's lockdown can end. Surveillance testing has been going on at workplaces in southwest Sydney. And so that's what has been picking up these people who have the virus and may not actually have any symptoms. Surveillance testing is basically testing people who don't feel unwell, they wouldn't otherwise get a test, and they don't need to isolate after that test as you usually would. So basically, people have been out in the community while they have had COVID because they don't know that they've had it. And that's why, of course, there is a lockdown to try and stop people moving around. Here's the New South Wales Chief Health Officer Kerry Chant on that issue.
So my clear message is, just because you don't have symptoms doesn't mean you're not infectious. And so we need to meet every moment of the day we're going about our business, and that should largely be in our house, therefore exposing no one else. But if we have to go to a central workplace, please follow all the COVID safe practices that have been put in place for those workplaces.
That's Kerry Chant there. And Isabel, we heard yesterday that a woman in her 50s had died at home from coronavirus. It's a really tragic case. What more do we know?
Yeah, so this was the mother of 2 men who we've heard were midway through a removalist trip into regional New South Wales when they got a call saying that they were COVID positive. The pair kept going to finish the job, and so they've been charged by police as a result for allegedly breaching public health orders. And then, sadly, this news came yesterday that their mother was the woman in her 50s who New South Wales Health say died while she was at home. Kerry Chant says that they knew this woman also had COVID and they'd offered to transport the family to an alternate facility for isolation, but they'd turned it down. There was local healthcare that have an outreach team in that circumstance, so that team was providing care. But Kerry Chant says it's a reminder that COVID is a dangerous virus for many people.
You can deteriorate quite quickly with COVID. We're not dealing with a mild case of flu where you've got some pre-existing immunity. This is not like that. Now, and I just want to reassure the community that those health services are available and we are here to care for you.
That's the New South Wales Chief Health Officer, Kerry Chant, and before that, our reporter, Isabel Rowe. Well, the first major independent study into COVID deaths in aged care homes in Victoria has been released. The researchers found that most deaths occurred at large, city-based, privately owned facilities, which had a history of failing to meet aged care standards. The study has been released today in the Australasian Journal on Ageing. One of the authors is Professor Joseph Ibrahim, head of the Health Law and Ageing Research Unit at Monash University.
Our study on the Victorian outbreak in Melbourne found that the highest case fatality rates were observed in homes owned by the not-for-profit providers who were operating multiple facilities and in areas where there were other high-risk industries that were likely to have COVID outbreaks.
And also homes that had had non-compliance with aged care standards as well, is that right?
Yes, that's right. So we looked at the relationship of the non-compliance in terms of whether there was a risk of an outbreak, the size of the outbreak and mortality.
So this is painting a picture of these bigger homes, part of chains, privately owned in metropolitan areas near high-risk industries. Why did those factors become so important in the number of deaths? What do you see?
I think the first thing is that it's obviously that the larger homes are more likely to be exposed with a greater number of residents affected. Also that the larger the outbreak, the more assistance and healthcare is required and the more staff that you need. So I think that there's certainly factors. The other thing is that the nature of the building of the nursing home, whether it's got single rooms, the type of ventilation also plays a factor in what's happening. The other thing that's been found with overseas research is that where there are large community outbreaks and the hospitals are providing a lot of care for the general population, that it's a struggle then to get the healthcare that's needed for residents in nursing homes.
And what do we know about why it is that it's the private sector homes that seem to have been hit hardest?
Well, I think to be fair to the private sector is the majority of privately owned homes are in metropolitan areas. The private homes tend to be larger in size and the private providers also tend to have multiple homes that they're operating, which increases the risk of getting an outbreak. Well, I think what was interesting was that some of the private homes were better able to contain an outbreak. So although they might have been at higher risk of having COVID enter, they were also able to contain it.
What do you think are the biggest lessons from this research?
Well, the biggest lessons for us and really what we were trying to do with this work was to show that there are at least four layers in looking at COVID outbreaks, and the risk of death is related to the resident themselves, how the nursing home is owned, operated, and what the preparation is, what's happening in the community, and so is there local community transmission and health services. And then the fourth layer is how did the nation prepare for the pandemic, given that there are so many interrelated factors that need coordination.
What are the messages out of this report for families who are trying to choose the safest place for their elderly loved ones?
Well, I think that's a very hard question. I think you go back to choosing a facility based on the needs of your loved one. I think that given that we're in the second year of the COVID pandemic, that I'd expect the majority of facilities to be far better prepared, as is the rest of the community.
What about the lessons for the sector and also for the government?
Well, I think there are massive lessons here for the government in terms of the how coordination of an emergency response, particularly in the pandemic, is organised. And I think for the providers, it highlights that they've got a central role in navigating how to best protect the resident. And to, I think they should be far more outspoken with government in getting the services that the residents they're providing care for need.
Were these deaths preventable?
Well, I've been on the record saying these deaths were preventable based on what we know back in April last year. And on the record with that, with the Royal Commission inquiry into COVID in August. And we knew a lot of the risk factors and how we could better prepare in March and April of 2020. Those steps weren't taken. So I think that the a larger number of the deaths were preventable based on our knowledge. And if Australia had achieved its true potential as a wealthy country with a very good health service.
That's Professor Joseph Ibrahim from the Health Law and Ageing Research Unit at Monash University. On ABC Radio, across Australia, streaming online and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Thanks for your company. Australia has joined the US, Japan, NATO and other countries in demanding that China stop supporting malicious cyber attacks. Overnight, the Biden administration and its Western allies officially blamed China for the massive hack into Microsoft's email server software earlier this year. But even with the international community banding together to ramp up the pressure on China, will it make any difference? David Sparks has more.
With these joint statements, governments across the world have signalled their anger at what they say is a campaign of hacking by China. The United States in particular says it's had enough.
We are here today to announce the indictment of four Chinese nationals for coordinating a multi-year conspiracy to hack into computer systems belonging private companies, universities, and government entities in the United States and around the world in order to steal sensitive research and technology.
Randy Grossman is acting U.S. attorney in the Southern District of California.
This case is about a cyber hacking and economic espionage campaign led by the government of China. The indictment alleges that three of the four defendants were intelligence officers with China's Ministry of State Security, or MSS. They implemented the alleged cyber attacks through front companies in order to conceal the government's role in the illicit scheme.
The Chinese embassy in Washington has called the accusations irresponsible. It says China never engages in cyber attacks or cyber theft. But the US and its allies have identified a range of cyber attacks. They include ransomware attacks with demands for millions of dollars and the theft of trade secrets, business information, new technologies, and infectious disease research. Alistair McGibbon is Australia's former National Cybersecurity Advisor. He's now with cybersecurity firm CyberCX.
So what's happened here is China has used contractors to carry out what you would suggest is a legitimate state-based espionage activity. And those contractors have then, for their own gain, carried out activities in parallel to what they were doing for the Chinese government. Yes, this is China, but it's China, working now with criminals to carry out not just activities for the Chinese state, but obviously for the criminals' own ends. And the world has come out and said that it's not acceptable what China's done.
Another cybersecurity expert, Nigel Fair from the University of New South Wales, says this moment has been coming for some time.
Well, over the last several decades, China has been slowly building up their malicious cyber capability, and now they aggressively target Australia and other allied nations from both a political, economic, military and educational perspective.
Is there any doubt that China is doing this?
There is no doubt at all. Attribution is a really difficult thing, but it's not an impossible thing. And, you know, when you're up against another nation state, they're also very good at understanding the attribution.
So I'm wondering if America does the same thing to China. I mean, America's calling on China and Russia to stop this. Do we know if America just does exactly the same thing to its adversaries?
I think you'll find all countries in the OECD top 20 have an offensive cyber capability. The real issue is how it's used and under what reasoning it's used. So when Australia might do something like that, it's under international norms of cyberspace. When other countries such as China or Russia do it, it's just to cause chaos and steal data. So there is some rules of the road around this, and some states abide by them and some don't.
And that's leading to the online equivalent of road rage between rival state actors. But what, if anything, can the law-abiding international community do about it?
It's important that countries, including Australia, call out bad online behaviour. The next question coming out of that is, what are the consequences for these nation states? Because at the moment, there are no consequences, and the only way to get them to stop will be from a consequential framework.
What should be the consequences?
Well, that's something for governments to really start thinking about when it comes down to. We've seen our issues with trade with China, when it comes to the general political behaviour between the two countries. There needs to be much greater discourse globally about what sanctions there could or couldn't be applied either against individuals and stopping how they operate, and also states themselves.
That's Nigel Fair from the Enterprise Institute for Cybersecurity at the University of New South Wales, ending that report from David Sparks. The Crown Royal Commission has been told the casino giant is not suitable to hold a licence to operate in Victoria. Counsel assisting the inquiry said the operators of the casino had breached public trust after evidence of money laundering facilitation and association with criminal gangs. Our senior business correspondent Peter Ryan has been covering the Royal Commission and joins us now. Peter, how likely is it that Crown will lose its licence to run its Melbourne casino?
Well, good afternoon, Sally. It is sounding pretty ominous for Crown, giving mounting evidence, some admitted by a few of Crown's top executives, about money laundering, facilitation, associations with shady junket operators paid to solicit high rollers, and outright poor management and poor compliance that constitute licence breaches. In addition to recommending the nuclear option, which would be the revocation of Crown's Melbourne licence, Counsel assisting Adrian Fanazio, SC, used his closing submission to say Crown's program of reform being overseen by Chairman Helen Coonan wasn't good enough and she wasn't a suitable person to be leading it. He also pointed to grave systemic breaches of law and sustained breaches of trust and confidence, warning that Crown will remain in a state of present unsuitability for some time. So recommendations that, if endorsed by the Royal Commission's findings, will be life-threatening to Crown.
It remains clear that Crown Melbourne is not presently suitable to hold the casino licence. The evidence reveals serious misconduct, illegal conduct, and highly inappropriate conduct, which has been encouraged or facilitated by a culture which has consistently put profit before all other considerations. This is a case where Crown may well stand condemned in the public mind as a company unfit to hold a licence. In all the circumstances, it's counsel assisting submission that it would be open for the Commission to recommend that the licence be cancelled.
Peter, what does all this mean for Victoria? If Crown loses its licence, what does it mean for jobs in Victoria?
Well, Sally, Crown Melbourne employs 12,000 staff, so it is Victoria's biggest employer, but Mr. Fanazio said his decision wasn't made lightly and was cognizant of the consequences that losing the licence would have on staff, given that it would be highly disruptive. There is a long way to go, though, but if Crown does lose its licence, it would be open to other casino operators who'll also need to prove their trust to the Victorian government, which gave Crown, 37% owned by James Packer, that licence back in the mid-1990s.
The market has been watching on. What's the reaction been from the share market?
Well, Sally, Crown's share price has been pretty much battered by the COVID situation and the lockdowns, but also what's come out of the Royal Commissions. Keep in mind there's one going on in Perth at the moment as well. Crown shares were down around 1.6% this morning in late morning trade. Crown gets a chance to respond to the final closing submissions on the 3rd of August when it makes its own final submission.
Peter, thank you. That's our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. That's all from the World Today team for this Tuesday. The PM team will be along this evening with the latest stories from across the country and right around the world. Thanks for your company. Join us again at the same time tomorrow. I'm Sally Sarah. Stay safe and have a great afternoon.
Hi, I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. The Tokyo Olympics will be the first with a transgender person competing in them. It's a big step for trans athletes, but access is still a long way from being guaranteed at any level of sport.
You know, technically they can just say, nope, sorry, no trans woman allowed ever. There are sports that do that.
Today on The Signal, we speak to trans athletes about what's fair and what's not when it comes to elite competition. Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.